We all have our golden hour, our time to de-stress and reflect. To reach new levels of calm and contentment, check out Plus CBD's Reserve Collection. It's crafted using the highest quality full-spectrum hemp oil for bigger, broader effects to help you experience deeper relaxation and a brighter mood. As you know, I'm a big proponent of CBD to tonify the endocannabinoid system, which regulates many of our most critical bodily functions, such as learning and memory, emotional processing, sleep, temperature and pain control, and inflammatory and immune responses. CBD is a real breakthrough in herbal products. The CBD brand that I take is Plus CBD from CV Sciences. Their Reserve Collection is a specially curated blend of cannabinoids, rich and bold, or when intense support is needed. Enjoy a deeper CBD experience with Plus CBD's Reserve Collection of oils and gummies. To learn more or to order, visit pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman and use coupon code Hoffman30 for 30% off. That's pluscbdoil.com/Hoffman for Plus CBD's Reserve Collection. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Very much looking forward to today's guest, who is author of a book entitled Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry. He's Austin Frerick. And to situate the discussion, America is a country that suffers inordinately from obesity and metabolic diseases. They're taking a terrible toll. And this is largely due to our diets. Ultra-processed foods make up 73% of the U.S. food supply, according to recent statistics. And some of this has to do with the fact that the food that we get is highly controlled by food barons. That's the contention of the book Barons by today's guest. And we're going to take a deep dive into how barons shape the American food supply, a food supply that tends to produce very negative results in terms of our overall health. And what does it say as a society that the food we produce and serve and the portions that we offer are of such poor quality that we fatten a generation of people, and then, ironically, we have to invent drugs to remove the desire to combat our own policies and culture. Isn't that a paradox? Is that this is a food system that is not by design to enhance health. It's designed to optimize profits. It's profit-driven. It's created a lot of innovation, but it's also created a lot of downsides, not just in terms of the health of Americans, but to the ecosystem, the environment, and to communities and the very social structure of America. Those are the points being made in the book, Barons. So we welcome Austin Frerick. Austin is a seventh generation Iowan. I don't know how you get to be a seventh generation. Did you come with the Vikings or something? I'm not sure how that worked out.
Close, but like Dyer's potato.
Okay. He has been very involved in food policy. He's an expert on agricultural and antitrust policy. He's worked at the Open Market Institutes, the U.S. Department of Treasury, and the Congressional Research Service before becoming a fellow at Yale University. He had, by virtue of his personal background, because I believe you are the first in your generation, the first in your family to have actually attended college. So you come from a rural family, farmers by profession, and so you have deep roots, but you have taken a different course. You are not, tilling the soil, but you're tilling the soil in a different way, trying to improve America's food policies, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I mean, just to clarify, my parents aren't farmers, but my dad's a corn syrup truck driver, and my mom is like a caregiver. But, you know, it's Iowa, grandparents farm, extended family members farm. Iowa is to agriculture, Hollywood is to films, is the way I kind of look at it.
So this has sort of shaped your advocacy for changing the course of American agriculture. And so, you know, give us a little bit of a case study of how things have gone awry, because, you know, we had traditional family farms, we had farm to table, that was the system. Perhaps it was inefficient in the name of efficiency. We've created vast conglomerates. We've created, you know, super retailers like Walmart and Amazon that bring all the latest efficiencies to the process of marketing and delivering food. But how has that poorly served us in terms of our health and in terms of America's social structure?
Yeah. So like I actually view Iowa's canary in the coal mine for the food system in America. I mean, Iowa should be Italy of the United States of North America, has some of the world's best soil, yet has the second highest cancer rate, has the second highest obesity rate. And you drive rural Iowa now and it just kind of feels like feels very industrial. Like you don't see animals, but you smell them. And so much of what, I mean, that happened in my lifetime. And that's kind of honestly the impetus for this book was what happened here. So like my book is structured. I have 7 robber barons, but they're really narrative devices to tell bigger structural stories. So like, for example, Cargill's my grain baron. That's really about the story of the farm bill and why we heavily subsidize highly processed foods, yet we give no subsidies like fresh food, and why this obesity crisis in America is a structural thing at the end of the day. And part of my book too is just the nice Iowa way of basically rejecting that whole change the system with your fork mentality. And the day you need to, a lot of these are oligopolies. We need old fashioned trust busting. We need to make structural changes. Like you change systems by changing systems.
Indeed. So there's also been a toll on the environment. You know, as you mentioned, these factory farms have really devastated the environment, have made living conditions very unpleasant. But also, you know, the advent of big retailers like Walmart, to a lesser extent Amazon, because they're more online, but they've sort of changed the character of rural America in a bad way. In some ways, you know, I hope you don't mind the comparison, but your book is a little bit like the hillbilly elegy of agriculture in America, because it's like the part of America that kind of got left behind and succumbed to industrialization, monopolies, and offshoring, right?
Yeah. I mean, I opened the book with my hog baron, and the hog baron is really talking about this industrial model. I mean, just to add on to your point about the negative externalities of this. So my hog baron does about 5 million hogs a year. So I tell the story of that regulatory capture, how you did it, but then also the consequences of that cash, like that power. Because he's now the most powerful person in the state. He cuts the governor a $300,000 check. And so Iowa has about 25 million hogs now. A hog defecates 3 times more than a human. So you're talking about the manure of 75 million people. That's California, Illinois, and Texas combined.
Wow.
At the same time, too, because of his campaign donations, that regulatory structure has been gutted.
Yeah, they talk about like hog lagoons. That kind of has a pretty dire connotation when the runoff from these farms has to be contained in these giant lakes that are diked off so that the runoff doesn't completely overrun the landscape.
Yeah, there's 2 different types of lagoons usually. In Iowa, they tend to be underneath the metal sheds. In North Carolina, in their hog production, they tend to be next to them, these massive open pits. So North Carolina was like the original OG here. So a state senator deregulated that in the 80s, and they started doing industrial hogs there first before Iowa, and they did in the poor black areas. It's actually, to me, one of the best examples in the food system of modern day structural racism.
So it's a NIMBY thing, not in my backyard, right? So it's away from the affluent areas, and it's pushed into the poor, underserved areas.
North Carolina is even darker, though, because in Iowa, what they do, they have to drain them every few months. They inject it into the soil, usually. In North Carolina, because of the water table level, it being the eastern shore, they spray it in the air, the hog manure.
Wow.
And so, yeah. So you have these stories of poor black churches having to repaint their steeples every few years because they turn brown.
That's sort of a variation on eau de cologne, right?
Yeah.
Goodness gracious. So these there's a lot of what's called crony capitalism involved. You know, you're alluding to the... there's a great deal of coordination between government, kind of a revolving door, between regulatory agencies and producers, you know, where the regulations, they just kind of run amok.
I mean, that's how you get to this moment. Actually, a lot of my anger in the book is focused on President Biden's current Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack, former governor of Iowa. People already know, a common thing I hear all the time is people blaming rural Americans for voting for this stuff. And I don't think people, especially in the Midwest context, I think it's fascinating to really dissect, because a lot of these rural counties Obama won twice. And I think underappreciated is the degree of Stockholm syndrome in a lot of these communities. They fought power and they lost. But people like Vilsack actually contributed to it big time. So in 2000, in the early 2000s, when he was running for re-election as governor, this hog issue was like the big issue in Iowa. He ran ads on it. He promised to do something. His actual main opponent was the head lobbyist for my hog baron. You had small town gyms being packed full of people, because not only are, you know, the family hog farmer going out of business, these things destroy your quality of life, right, and also your home value. Your home values collapse. And the way Iowa works is only the governor of Iowa can stop the construction of these confinements, which, by the way, he voted for as a state senator. But then after he promised to do something as governor, when he won, he then not only did he not do anything, he oversaw the expansion, the largest expansion of these industrial hog facilities in Iowa history. And between serving under President Obama and serving under President Biden, he served as an industrial dairy lobbyist. That's why there's been a lot of talk about meatpacking, doing something about, look at these companies exploiting workers, exploiting children. But the fact is, the meat markets have gotten more concentrated these last 4 years because he's done nothing. He's a lobbyist at his core. And I want to tell that story. I mean, that's the undercurrent here. A lot of people, especially in rural areas, have heard talk of doing something, but there's not much action. And so people just don't trust the system anymore.
And it seems to be a bipartisan problem because, you know, whether it's a red state or a blue state, powers that be, the industrialists, can always find their advocates, because money talks and campaign funds are scarce. So, yeah. That's kind of how it works.
Yes, it takes two to tango, but I want to be careful to say, like, it's clearly one party contributed more than the other. I mean, on the flip side, North Carolina actually put a moratorium in so that you can't build any more of these industrial hog facilities. And that's honestly partly in response to hurricanes that hit the state. And with all that rain, these lagoons just flooded everything. And the urban centers were like, we're not going to have any of this. Like, we're done. And I mean, you're seeing this actually in the Midwest now, where so industrial dairy is collapsing out west. It's trying to move back to the Midwest. And a lot of states are like, we don't want that. I mean, we saw what happened in Iowa. We saw basically Iowa's become an extraction colony. And people don't like, I mean, I forgot to mention, because of all this manure and all the fertilizer used to grow the feed for these industrial animals, about 60 to 70% of the waterways in Iowa are too polluted for you to go into.
Wow. Yeah. So you can't fish anymore. You can't, you know, go to the local stream and swim. It really has destroyed the quality of life for a lot of rural areas. This is certainly a problem. You know, another issue too is our system of agricultural subsidies, which are really wrongheaded when it comes to health goals. You know, we've got subsidies for all the things that go into cheap processed food that's highly caloric. I think we even still have sugar subsidies, if I'm not mistaken, but certainly corn, soy, and things like that. You state in the book that the cost, you know, inflation adjusted, of fresh fruits and vegetables has gone way up, but the cost of highly processed food relative to inflation has gone relatively down, you know, compared to maybe a couple of decades ago. Why is that?
Yeah, because right now the Farm Bill picks favorites. Historically, going back to New Deal, the Farm Bill tried to, I call it the Goldilocks, where it tried to figure out like an ecological balance of, sure, you might get some subsidies, but that came with a stick where you had to engage in conservation, which usually meant taking land out of production. There's a cap for how much subsidies you could get.
In other words, the point being is this: people find this notion ridiculous, but there's a reason for this. You get paid for not growing stuff, which is, it's like,
what? I mean, it's rooted in the Dust Bowl.
Yeah.
I mean, what's fascinating about, I mean, you're kind of seeing parallels right now with the Ukraine war. We can come back to that in a second. But basically, during World War I, America aggressively expanded its agricultural land, you know, to fill the void of all the land being taken out of production in Europe. But then after World War I, these markets were glutted and people were engaging in really destructive environmental practices in order to save their land. You know, I mean, so you just had this incentive structure to keep pushing more and more and more.
So like almost slash and burn agriculture, ravaging the soil.
Marginal land, riverbed land, putting in production. And so, you know, part of that conservation thing was taking away that incentive. But fast forward, I mean, I call the modern Farm Bill the Wall Street Farm Bill because, and I really focus on the 1996 one. A few months after President Bush signed the program, you know, gutting welfare assistance to working poor moms, he signed in the Wall Street Farm Bill. And what that essentially did is it went from a Goldilocks, it flipped it to an overproduction model. So for crop insurance, to me, is the best example of it. First of all, there's no cap on it. And unbeknownst to most Americans, Bill Gates is one of the largest owners of farmland in America. So you can get as much of his crop insurance as he wants. On top of it, it's not what you think it is. It's not like a rainy day hurricane thing. It's insurance for low prices, where 60% of your premium is paid for by the taxpayer. Wow. And it's only for a few crops. Like, it's not for carrots, it's for corn.
Yeah.
So it essentially pushes you not to grow vegetables, but it pushes you to do corn. So Bill Gates can get as much insurance as he wants to grow corn. And I argue that's why you get all these like dumb, illogical ideas like ethanol. Like ethanol is basically an artificial demand to soak up unnecessary surplus. We're producing too much corn. So instead of, you know, growing rye or carrots or something else, we just find artificial uses for an overproduction because that's what my great bear wants. Unbeknownst to most Americans, Cargill is actually the largest private company in America. They're bigger than the Koch brothers. They trade one in three, one in four grains globally. I mean, the sun never sets on their empire. And so they were a really key big player in, you know, pushing for this overproduction grain production model. And I mean, we're paying for it at the store. It's weird. Even like, what's funny about that, like your stat of how highly processed food's gotten cheaper, fresh food's gotten more expensive. Even pulling back for a second, what blows most people's minds is Americans actually spend more money on food than a lot of other Western democracies.
Mm-hmm.
Which we shouldn't be shocked. Concentrated markets gouge is what they do. It's actually really rampant in the meat industry. So it's like, we're paying more and we're also like, we're paying more for junk. That's the way I kind of look at it.
Yeah. Certainly not commensurate with the quality. It's not a merit system. But, you know, some people will push back on your notion that, you know, this is too concentrated, that the big players are monopolizing things. And they'll say, look, you know, with consolidation comes economy of scale. You know, after all, we have to feed, you know, hundreds of millions of people. The answer to worldwide poverty and the threat of starvation is to make agriculture more efficient, you know, have super farms, have automation, have high tech deliver us the most diverse food supply that we can possibly imagine. So that, you know, in a supermarket, you can find exotic treats from all over the world at your fingertips. Rather than, you know, have, you know, local farmers on small plots of land doing sustainable agriculture and offering high quality products. It's just, some people might say that's just not a model that can cope with the food needs of America and the world. What say you?
Oh, yeah. I hear that all the time. It's usually tenured faculty at land grants who tend to take a lot of money from industry. I mean, the first thing I ask those people are, do you think alcohol is good for the climate? And if they say yes, then, you know what I mean? They're just hacks. Anyone that thinks
it does burn good for the climate, it does produce CO2, right?
Yeah. And you use a ton of fossil fuels to grow it. The whole thing is, anyone thing that thinks it's good for the climate and believes the world is flat. Secretary Vilsack is trying to put in their airplanes and call it good for the climate. His son works for an ethanol baron. That's a whole different conversation. But to those people, what I respond are two things. One, even when we talk about, I really do think the food area in America is the most concentrated space. Because even when we talk about it, we tend to use national figures. But that's just like, that you can't do that. It's not a search engine. You don't take a cattle in Montana and butcher in South Carolina. So like, when you drill down, I had someone present a paper at Yale Law School a few years ago where like one company has an 85% market share of fluid milk in New England and the tri-state area of New York City.
That's a pretty impressive monopoly.
It is. Does anyone, I don't need a PhD in econ to know you're probably not paying a competitive price for milk when someone has that much market concentration. Mm-hmm. And there's also this whole illusion of choice. Like the other example I like to use is peanut butter. Like Smucker's has like a 56% market share of peanut butter, but they own a bunch of other brands and the market share is likely higher because they tend to do the store brands. They only know that is when there's a peanut recall.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds weird to say, but I keep going back to the Goldilocks thing. There is a sweet spot. There is efficiencies to be had, but at some point things can go too far and you just see regulatory capture happen where people try and entrench their monopoly and pass the cost of their production on to someone else and exploit labor. Race to the bottom, you could say. And my little stat to end with is bacon adjusted for inflation, according to the Good Housekeeping, was cheaper under the same price as Truman as it was under President Obama. So it's like, in the day, you're just raising a hog and butchering it. Like, at some point where you can only get so many efficiencies, you can make a faster bacon slicer, but like, this isn't, the margins here aren't huge.
Right. So obviously it's profit driven, and there are ways that big outfits like Walmart, for example, Amazon too, who dominate the landscape of retail in the United States when it comes to food, that they can quash innovation. That there's this whole thing about what's called shelf space. And it's almost like it's been referred to as mafioso capitalism, because it's kind of like, hey, pay up, buddy, so that you can get some very valued shelf space in our stores, when it should be the opposite. These companies should be seeking out innovative products that are healthy and appealing to the American public. But no, that's also profit driven.
Yeah, it's pay to play. I mean, earlier this spring, it was announced that Walmart is buying a TV maker, and people are wondering why, and it's pay to play.
Yeah, but it's also vertical integration, because you know it's kind of that Rockefeller model is that you own the oil derricks, you extract the oil, you own the pipelines, you own the the trucks that transport it. You own the gas stations, it's all the way down the line that you exert control. So you, in effect, you're buying from yourself.
Yeah. And like for the TV thing, it's a digital slotting fee. That's the way I look at it. It's like when you type in, that's what gets harder. It's not like you talk to grocery people and they'll tell you, they know right away what's going on. You buy ads on Walmart TVs. And then you get the end cap, like the best spot in the grocery store is always that end spot. You know what I mean? It's one of those things where Walmart, to my knowledge, generally doesn't charge a slotting fee, but they do it indirectly. And that, the grocery store people will tell you they do it this way, they do it that way, but it's the same concept. But that's, even writing that chapter, I think Walmart is the king of kings. It's incredibly fascinating. And that chapter is twice the length of anyone else, because I don't think we truly grappled with their power. I mean, they sell 1 in 3 groceries. Their market share is the same in grocery as the 2nd, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th combined. I think they're the closest thing we've ever had in America to a Soviet Union-style Politburo.
Yes.
If you're Smuckers, you're so big. You are nothing compared to Walmart. It's supply and command. Walmart dictates to you. I mean, they are a third of your sales. You have no bargaining power there. And what's even more scary right now is, I have a slaughtering bear in my book, JBS. They famously or allegedly famously gouged a lot during COVID, and you don't do that to Walmart. And so Walmart's even it's making vertical plays right now into beef and dairy. It's building its own beef plant in Wichita. Mm-hmm. Dairy. It just announced its third dairy plant down in Waco, and that is what has a cost insight into these markets. It doesn't want to fully vertically integrate like Costco did in chickens outside the Omaha area, but it wants to know the cost structure so that when
the famous Costco chickens that are so incredibly inexpensive, then you walk in the store and you come out with $97 worth of other stuff.
Yeah.
It's what's called a loss leader. Yeah.
And famously, I mean, in the meat world, I don't know if this is true, but a few years ago, Costco was it's been a disaster for them because the chicken space is ruthless. And Costco, that's hard. That's a hard space. I mean, you're really exploiting undocumented labor. I mean, Tyson's is the original OG there. I mean, the whole model of chicken production comes from sharecropping in the South. I mean, it's an incredibly exploitative model. And these companies are ruthless. I mean, we are back in the era of the jungle.
Right. And so you also talk about what this, the effort to shrink the margin causes in terms of worker safety, in terms of working conditions, in terms of offshoring, often to other countries where the regulations aren't as stringent. Mexico, for example, which is a real breadbasket for America, where you can get cheap labor to do stuff under far less stringent labor regulations. So that NAFTA actually introduced a whole new dimension to this offshoring of agriculture and industry.
Yeah, that was the goal of my Driscoll chapter. So Driscoll's my berry baron. So they sell 1 in 3 berries.
By the way, I'm sure you're aware that there was a very, very flattering piece about Driscoll that just appeared in the Wall Street Journal. And I read it and I said, what a great company. They're so into innovation and they have developed these wonderful, tasty berries. And I thought, wow, so high tech. This is great. You cast them in a little bit of a darker light, you know. And by the way, when I buy berries, I look and 80% of it is Driscoll. It's Driscoll, Driscoll, Driscoll. They're like the berry barons. They really are.
Yeah. They grow berries on every continent in the world except Antarctica at this point.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, like, just to a point earlier, barons beget barons. Big boys like to run with big boys. So the creation of Walmart triggers creation of a berry baron because, like, the Driscoll's realized Walmart wants one company to do 4 berries year-round for 4,000 stores. So sometimes your berries are coming from Morocco, sometimes they're coming from Argentina. Who knows? Oh, but to that news article you reference, it took a lot of digging deep not to, like, you know, spout off on Twitter. Because here's the thing, I know how this game works. That story was handed to that reporter. It's an easy copy to write. And you're writing a book like this, all I did is read fluff. To me, it was the worst with my dairy baron. I mean, they sold such a positive climate change narrative when they actually engaged with an incredibly destructive climate model on production.
There's a lot of greenwashing.
Yeah. And, like, I mean, that's just adding on to all that is, like, for example, Des Moines Register used to have one of the best agriculture newspaper sections in America. It's been gutted. Private equity gutted it. There's one person who covers agriculture now in Iowa, one journalist. And so many of these stories aren't being told, and you just have, like, journalist on the coast who gets handed a story. That's why, like, a lot of industry propaganda really sets the narratives in a lot of these places. It's filled the void.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we've outlined a lot of the problems. We're going to go to part two. In part two, I want to talk about, you know, potential solutions because, you know, the forces of capitalism unrestrained when it comes to the food supply have resulted in really a calamitous effect on the American diet, the American environment, and the American social structure. I think that you make the point very well. There've got to be some solutions. So we're going to talk solutions in part two. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest today is Austin Frerich. Austin is an expert on agricultural and antitrust policy and is a fellow at Yale University, author of a great book, Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food and Industry, blowing the lid off some of the biggest corporations and conglomerates that render us our highly questionable food supply. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.